Nice to have music going in the background here as I can exalt and lift my spirit. Anyway, welcome everyone. This is the final talk in our Four Noble Truth year and 2 month long series. You think you're tired of it. And this is our only opportunity to talk about wise samadhi. So we won't even have a discussion group next week. I'll be in Massachusetts for the next 6 weeks together. So this will be our only opportunity to really focus in on this particular topic, and it's a critical one, so I don't want to demean it in any way at all. And it's really the culmination of the Eightfold Path. And we need to look at that because there's so much confusion about this word samadhi. I think it's used in a variety of different ways and different traditions. The Hindu tradition, which is where I started early on, uses it almost as the culmination of what where all the yogas end. And although I practiced diligently in that tradition, I didn't find my mind moving in to what they termed or described as samadhi. So I think what it might hint towards in that tradition is what we call the jhanas or absorption states in this tradition. I don't know, though. But I do know that even within the Buddhist tradition, samadhi is a term that can mean many different things. So it's a very important term, and I don't want to make this too academic, but it's important to define it in a way that we understand that our practice is really moving in that direction towards wise samadhi. And also to remember that all of the Eightfold Path is in service to wise view. Any of these links, speech, action, and etc., mindfulness, can all be unwise if they are used with unwise view, if they are used to further reinforce the sense of I, to direct our attention towards our accomplishment, towards our ambition, towards our striving goal, if we use them for a sense of self-enhancement. It's not that unwise is wrong. It's just unwise. It moves in the wrong direction. It's not bad for us to do that. It just doesn't move us in the direction of the Buddha's teaching, in the direction of freedom. Just this last day long, at the very end of the day long, I asked if there were any remaining residual questions, and one man raised his hand and said he was interested in the particular meditation that allowed him to actualize his dreams, so that he, I think he'd been reading about this meditation that's going around now called The Secret, or I'm not really familiar with it, so I'm not going to speak about it. But you hold what's deepest, your deepest intention in terms of worldly gain, and then you make the universe move in that direction. And I said to him, I have no doubt at all that that works. I'm sure that we could all spend our hours directing our minds towards what materialistically or in status, prestige, we would like. But that's not the direction of the Buddha's teaching. It's not that it's wrong. It's just not in the direction of freedom. I have to keep saying that because we can become snobs in this game where we think that we're better than because we are using our meditation in the wise view and other people are using it in the unwise view. It's just that that's not where our heart yearns. If we look at the intention of what we really want beyond all the flutter and flurry of the many ways that our market economy tries to reach out and tell us what we need, if we look beyond all of that mess, that confusion, we find a true intentionality in our heart, a true longing in our heart that pulls us in a very different way, then the forces of the economy seem to direct us. And it's towards a greater sense of abiding. There are many ways that we can use or sum up wise view, abiding in heart, connection, interconnectedness. All of these are just terms that try to point towards that, towards the fundamental reality of all things when we aren't isolated within our own self-image. So if we use the tools an Eightfold Path to enhance our self-image, we are never going to satisfy that deepest yearning. And my hope is that we're gathered here around that deepest yearning, because if you're not, if you have other intentions, and it doesn't mean that we don't have two levels of intention going simultaneously, but if we don't have any sense of resonance with that deepest yearning, this really isn't the Sangha for you. There are other meditation techniques that will point you towards your intentionality. But I, in my 60th year, it's beginning to become extremely clear to me, with time running out of the hourglass, that this is the only direction that I want to take. And I'm hoping that people who come to SIMS also have that intentionality. So it's with that that we move into this next link of the Eightfold Path and redefine samadhi and differentiate samadhi from concentration, which I will do in a minute or two. But samadhi does not mean concentration. That samadhi is steadiness of consciousness itself, steadiness of mind, mental harmony, or oneness of mind. It's a mind that holds itself very steadfast. And there's an evolution of, as there are in all of these cases, of samadhi, which involves from the very earliest ways that we're trying to steady our attention upon our breath and to up until the point where we're able to hold the whole of our consciousness very firm. And it's in that firmness where thought is passing through but is not determining the course of the consciousness. That's perhaps some of us have had moments in which that has been our perception. We have to be very careful again of what it is that's behind that perception of steadiness. If it's a sense of, oh, I'm doing really well, this is great, this is what the books are all talking about here, my mind is real firm. See, we're using the steadiness to reaffirm the wrong view. But if we hold that steadiness and are even quieter, we begin to see that very subtle thinking that's back there trying to form itself into one wise view, but because we're holding a different intentionality for our steadiness, we're not going to let that form around the image of me, and therefore it tries to form, but it doesn't, just can't quite cluster and then falls away. And in that falling away is a universality of oneness. When the mind isn't seen through thought. See, I mean, just look at this in terms of intellectual logic. Thought holds, thought is a description of a part of life. It holds a particular perception of a part of life, lamp. And if we look through thought, we see lamp. Now, if we're quiet and see the word lamp, but don't look through that thought, then this is not separated from everything else. It is when we look through the word. It isn't when the word floats by. We still know it to be lamp, but we don't separate it out from all other possible things and events and experiences. And so when samadhi is very still, when the mind is very quiet, those thoughts are heard rather and inform the consciousness as to what of the appropriate thing to do is. But it doesn't confiscate the consciousness so that it only knows a word through those words. That is connectedness. When we see without being directed by the word, the inherent quality of that seeing is connected. It's connected because there are no things anymore. There are no things separated from one another. So we begin to see that it is just the neurotic mind that has to look through the word constantly that holds the world to be multiple events and multiple things, the thingness of life. And when we're quiet, we can see differently from that. It's very hard to get a feeling for that, and I'm not playing down the difficulty at all. Because we have to be very quiet. Our intention has to be we have to be driven by our intentionality. If we want something from life, we're going to find the correct word to look through to be able to navigate ourselves to whatever it is that we want. That's why desire and fear fracture the mind and samadhi heals it into oneness. Do you get a sense of that? But if our intentionality is towards connection, if our view of life is towards connecting, then we will bypass the momentary goal of the acquisition to come to the deeper yearning of the collected, of the collection of all things, the connection of all things. So you see, wise view goes through an evolution as well. Wise view starts out with an idea, and we don't really know what the idea. The idea seems very foreign and kind of a fantasy in some ways. Everything is connected, a oneness. It sounds very new agey and a little bit sour to the tongue. And but like all things, we begin with an idea and we journey it until our heart begins to resonate sufficiently. And we begin to see that the domain of the heart really holds the better half of myself. And I say that because the other half of myself is not heart intended at all. And the deepest way, our deepest intention for ourselves is to come more and more into our heart. And so as we settle more and more into that deeper level of intentionality, we give less credence to the mind which seems to fracture and diversify. And so then we move from wise view being an idea that we start out with, that we have no relationship with except conceptually. It sounds like a good idea. Let's all be connected. To the actual experience of oneness, of connectedness. Which is why wise samadhi is the eighth step of the Eightfold Path. It is the culmination of the other seven. But all of the other seven, especially the first two, view and intentionality, hold and firm up that aspect of samadhi. So it's not as if it's devoid of the other seven steps. It's just that it culminates. It's the final fact, the final seeing, the experience of. So to understand samadhi is not just concentrating on our breath, that we begin to understand through samadhi the wisdom of non-reaction. Because when we react, when we move, when the mind moves in accordance with what it fears or desires, which is reaction, then the whole thing is confused. It's like we live on the edge of a woods, and every once in a while a dog will up there will bark, and the crows in the trees will just fly forth. Hundreds of thousands of them, it seems to me. So it blackens the sky. That's what the reactivity will do to the open space of samadhi. It will just blacken the sky, confusing everything. And so all of these different the non-reaction, desire, you begin to see that what we're trying to do is to hold this precious understanding of interconnectedness, the culmination, and that desires and fears take away or seem to subtract us out of that, to get us back into a different view of life, a different intentionality of life, which doesn't serve us and it doesn't serve others. And we also see something very inspiring, I feel. At one point the Buddha was asked, he says, please, sir, state your teachings. What do you teach? And he says, well, I only teach three things. I teach samadhi, and I teach panya, wisdom, samadhi, and ethical conduct. That's all I teach. Now, he wasn't saying, I teach following your breath. He was teaching samadhi. He was teaching steadiness of mind. Steadiness of mind. From that steadiness of mind, that's the platform from which all things come together. But he was also teaching ethical conduct. Now, how does ethical conduct feed samadhi? Well, it's actually quite beautifully. When samadhi holds things as being together, then ethical conduct is the natural inclination or appropriate action from things being together. If we remember that all things good, and I use this not in a moralistic sense, but in an everyday use of the word good and evil, that which brings things together can be defined as good. That which separates things could be defined as evil. If you think of any act that we call evil, it separates. If you think of any act that we call good, it brings things together. So when you see things being together, your actions are going to be in accordance with basic goodness. It's not a moralistic drive in us to be good. It's the nature of what we see, and actions come appropriately from that nature. So samadhi has a basic goodness associated with it, a basic harmony, a basic accommodation. And it has a basic wisdom, because it's not seen through thought, it's seeing things as they are, without the taint of our opinions associated with the thinking about something. Another way of saying all this is that the quieter we become in ourselves, the less divisiveness and division there is displayed externally and internally. Now, what is the difference between samadhi and concentration? And I think it's an important... In the beginning, as I mentioned, all we know how to do is to think. And the very basic teaching is to try to learn that there's some aspect of life outside of thought. And to try to, again and again, refocus our attention on an experience that isn't leveled and layered with our thinking about it. And slowly through that, we begin to discern the difference between an experience that's occurring and the quick knee-jerk thought we have about that experience. So we're beginning to focus on something. We're beginning to steady our attention on something. If our world is just the world of thought, our minds are not steady upon anything. They just go from one thought to another. It's just a passing of the baton as one thought moves in and enmeshes and moves into another whole set of thoughts and thinkings, and it just goes like that. So there's no reality outside of our thinking. We're just seeing the world through our constant divisive image that we hold of things. I hope this isn't too technical. I don't mean it to be. So concentration is an access way. It's a very important. It's a cultivated, scientific, as I put it, you know, number of breaths over time increases. If you spend time with your breath, you will have more and more breaths that you are going to be present to. So it's a training. It's an important training. So that aids the ability to hold our mind's attention steady. Now, there are two distinct forms of concentration. One is one-pointed concentration. That's when you have excluded all other objects from your attention except one object, one-pointed object. It could be on the breath, or it could be on a physical sensation, or it could be on any number of other experiences, or it could be on a candle flame, or it could be on a mandala, or it could be on metta practice, for instance. Just saying those words over and over again is a very strong form of concentration practice. That's all one-pointed. The simile is if you're on a street corner and cars are passing by, you're noticing each car as they go by. So there's Buick and Cadillac and Mercedes and Honda and Toyota. And each car represents your whole world as it moves across that corner. Then there is moment-to-moment concentration. Moment-to-moment concentration is stopping at that corner, standing on that corner, and opening up your gaze so that it sees all the cars that's moving through your vision, rather than following each particular one. So now you're aware of all the cars simultaneously. So that one-pointed concentration evolves into moment-to-moment concentration, which is a close proximity to samadhi. You see? So that we have the beginning capacity not just to hold our attention upon each and individual experience as it's occurring, but now we're beginning to relax, which is essential. The other one has a kind of tightness associated with it. I've got to catch the next car. What was that? And the breath. And there's a kind of tension involved in concentration if we're not clear upon about what we're doing. But when we're trying to be quiet and see all the cars, then the tension is off. And we're just watching the cars move through the street corner as they're moving. That's the difference between one-pointed concentration and moment-to-moment concentration. Now, moment-to-moment concentration is not dependent upon a protected venue. This is very important. One-pointed concentration, we have to seclude ourselves off. If you, for instance, were practicing one-pointed concentration during our last sitting, say, focusing on your breath, and the choir was going on, that was a disturbance to you as you were trying to focus your attention on your breath. But if you were in moment-to-moment concentration, then that choir was part of the entire contemplation of the moment. It wasn't excluding, or there was no tension associated with the choir singing and the breath arising. Do you see the difference? One requires a specific environment. One requires a retreat setting or a small corner in your house when nobody comes into it. And there's an inflexibility to it. Not that it's wrong. It just requires a very tight setting for it to occur. And so many retreat settings are geared towards the cultivation of that one-pointed concentration. And so they are out in the woods and very secluded, and everybody is quiet, and the less noise the better, and all of that. But the moment-to-moment concentration, which is the stepping into the whole range of things, that's very different. That approaches the ability of the mind to do whatever it's doing, and I'm just, my comprehension is clear and broad enough so that it sees all of the, hears the choir, it feels my breath moving, the thoughts are moving through the sky of my mind, emotions might be arising. It's more choiceless awareness than specific awareness. Now, how one feeds the other is that when we start our meditation, we're much more apt to be one-pointed in our concentration. And there is a very particular reason why we do that. Unless we see each thing up close exactly as it is, and at the exclusion of other interfering experiences, we're never going to feel completely safe with that thing. Feeling safe with that is essential for us to be able to relax with it. With an emotion, with a physical sensation like pain, with an itch, with sounds. There's so much that comes in terms of our reaction to those sounds, our bitterness about those sounds occurring, our whatever history we have associated with those experiences, that unless we see the experience itself, just for itself, we won't be able to intimate that it is in fact harmless, that it holds no destructive capacity other than the capacity of my fear that I give it. And so we won't relax with it. We won't simmer down. We won't say, okay, wait a second here. It's just this breath. It's just the physical pain in my knee. It's just an itch. After we have looked a number of times, repetitiously, over the whole length and square mileage of our consciousness, all of the different emotions, those emotions that we are most afraid of, like loneliness, or depression, or fear, a number of times, slowly something happens. Slowly, not only are the strength of our concentration occurring, and gaining speed, and cultivating, and nourishing, so that we have the ability, almost laser-like, to be able to place our attention on things, but also wisdom is beginning to accrue, and the fact that there is a harmlessness about our consciousness as a whole. Wait a second here. There's nothing in here that I need to feel as a betrayal. There's nothing in here I need to hide from or hide other people from. That it's all just coming and going, and it doesn't really claim any ownership anywhere. With that comes a deeper sense of relaxation. With a deeper sense of relaxation comes a less of a need to protect ourselves from what's occurring. When we protect ourselves less, we're not as vocal. The way we protect ourselves in our mind is through our verbal defensiveness, by holding something to be that and moving back and developing a story about it, how I've got to get out of this awful pain I have in my knee, and how if I don't move, it's going to, all of that. The story's quiet down. The reaction's quiet down, the consciousness opens up. Lo and behold, it opens up into samadhi, into clarity, into discernment, into seeing. Seeing was always there. The crows were confiscating the sky. With the crows landed again into the trees, nested, the sky opens up. It's always been there. It's always been, I'm not frightened anymore. And with that, the whole thing of connection and interconnection and wise view, everything becomes very clear, very easy to see. You see, the Buddha called that clear comprehension. Clear comprehension, I think, is another term that's misunderstood, like samadhi, because I think samadhi and clear comprehension are one and the same. In samadhi, the motivation for what we're doing and why we're doing it is known, because that's part of the consciousness, and the whole of the consciousness is known. In one-pointed concentration, quite likely, the motivation for what you're doing is not known, because the whole energetic response is towards the object, not towards the what it is that's motivating the action to the object. But the Buddha said in his sutta on Anapanasati, which is mindfulness of the breath, he said, know when your attention is on the breath and when it's not. He did not say, always have your attention on the breath. Knowing when the attention is on the breath, knowing when the attention is off the breath. That knowing quality is the samadhi factor, which is always present, regardless of whether the one-pointedness is there or not. Oh, not on the breath. We make it into such a ill-conceived task that we have to fail. That's wrong view. That's unwise view. We're putting ourselves as an accomplished feat into this task. And now I have to get this task. See, that's not wise. It's not correct, it's not true, and it's not wise. But to know when we're on the breath and to know when the mind has lost its connection with the breath, to when thinking has occurred, to relax to this whole thing, not to make it so individually precious to us, so specific and so identified with the tragedy of my lack of attention and lack of concentration and what a terrible meditator I am, is to go the wrong direction. And every step of the way, we can apply unwise view and go the wrong direction with something that has no intention. The tool was never derived for that purpose at all. That's why wise and unwise, knowing wise and unwise view, holding that always as the, at the forefront of whatever we're doing is essential. Or we can just get lost in the story of our life and how tragically what a tragic mistake we've been in most tasks that have been presented to us in our history of failure and all of that. What does that have to do with anything that we're talking about? It's just reinforcing the very life we are living. It's not entering a new dimension. We're interested in entering a new dimension of interconnectedness. Interconnectedness cannot be entered through self, because the embodiment of self is the denial of that dimension. And so everything we do has to be oriented not towards self-criticism, but towards seeing that which is criticizing, seeing those thoughts, those tendencies, those attitudes and emotions, and holding them not with identifying reference, but just as things that are coming and going on their own. Now, there are lots of benefits to concentration, and I'm not in any way suggesting that concentration doesn't have a very positive and important component to play in everyone's meditation. I spent a long time just doing nothing but following my breath and doing all the things that most people do on this thing. It provides a sense of quiet and calm and tranquility. Very seductive, because they can also be traps, but they're only traps when we assert unwise view. They're never traps when we keep wise view of interconnection. They never become traps. They're not something that I'm going to try to nourish because they feel so good to have around. That, you can hear it, can't you? Just slid right into unwise view. Tranquility for itself, not for me. Calmness for itself, not for me. Awareness for itself, not mine, not I, me, and mine. And so the ability to sustain our attention upon something and the enormous value of understanding what that experience is like and what all experiences, the basic nature of all experiences, those are the values of concentration. But the traps are considerable. And no matter what the object is, where we're one-pointed and focused on them, the result of one-pointed focus is very alluring to most people. In fact, I often do a retreat that's in conjunction with or right after a long concentration retreat that some other teacher teaches, and those students who have done that long prolonged concentration retreat then come into the retreat that I'm doing sometimes, and often it's very difficult for me to get them out of their concentration space into insight. So concentration can be the denial of insight. I don't want to learn anything. I just want to abide in this beautiful room that I've created in my mind. The tales that go, what happens though is when these people go home, they come back and tell me that their irritation, because their concentration can't be sustained outside of a specialized environment, they go home and noise bothers them and people bother them, horns bother them, and everything's bothered them. They're miserable and their suffering has increased dramatically. But that's not the point, you see, to them. That's not the point. The fact that their suffering hasn't diminished, that their meditation isn't diminishing their suffering, which is the Buddha's teaching, they want to get back to that precious space again. And any time we have an experience that we are craving, by definition, we will suffer in relationship to its coming, arising and passing away, which it inevitably will. So that's one of the traps of concentration. Another trap is the power that it gives us. You can do anything. All of the things that you hear Christ has done, did, walking on water, all of those are powers that are possible with the power of concentration. In fact, if you've read Deepa Ma's book, who is an elderly woman in this tradition, who I had the fortune of meeting, she did all those things. She was invisible and was in two places at one time and all of that. But can you imagine what a Westerner would do that with kind of power? Well, first of all, they would be captured by the military immediately. But because we're so power-driven, we're so power-hungry, because you have to understand, you see, we feel so self-diminished that power, the sense of power, offsets that sense of self-diminishment, that we yearn for power almost beyond the yearning of the heart. And so one of the reasons that you don't see or haven't seen that kind of manifestation is because of the destructive capacity it would have upon this culture. Be terrible. And so you don't have people demonstrating that. But it's possible. I have no doubt you can read it and there's ways to get to it and do all those things. And gives you enormous amount of control and influence. But is that wise or unwise to you? You see? Just ask that question. And you know immediately whether you're going towards or away from what the intended direction is. Is power wise or unwise? Well, if I'm using it for the good of... No. You're using it for any purpose. Even if your intention is for the good, it's still unwise. Because it's... Again, when we are seeing what the world needs, awareness can't tell you what is needed. And it's awareness. It's the intelligence beyond ours. It's the discerning quality beyond our intellect. that holds the truth, not our thinking what the world needs. Would anybody wish what is now upon us to be here? Although it is in the perfection of the unfolding of life, we would have arranged it very differently, wouldn't we? Well, it's probably very good that we're not in charge. Now, I want to get to how to build our samadhi, work upon our samadhi, and just a few themes. One is perceptual action. I just, no matter how, where you start in this, just be good people. Just no matter where you, don't lie. Just the basic precepts. Just live perceptually. And your mind, it starts working advantageously for your practice. Your mind gets cleared out. Your concentration and samadhi grows considerably. You see, just wherever we however we understand ethical conduct, begin there. Enter it. And you'll find that less noise. There'll be less noise in the mind, less paranoia, less worry associated with all of the unskillful actions that we have normally taken. So that's one of the most important training blocks. That's why the Buddha said sila, samadhi, and panya. Those three go together. He wasn't saying be good because be good. It wasn't like a, fairyland. He was showing you how to train the mind, how to see interconnection. And just that habitual sustaining and cultivating the qualities of mind, repetition of practice, seeing again and again. Don't let boredom interface there between. Keep an interest even on the 10,000th observation of whatever attitude or mood you're in. Bring a fresh response. Okay, what is this about? Well, so this is what it's like to feel angry. This is what anger feels like. This is interesting. Look at this. This is what loneliness feels like. And to see the harmlessness of all of those experiences, that the mind is essentially harmless, no matter what. And maybe we have to work psychotherapeutically as well as other ways in order to understand that. Maybe there's too much story and too much tension around the story for us to be able to perceive that. But let us begin that journey of the harmlessness of experience. The harmlessness of experience. And then fearless observation. That's another, I'm just showing you the what qualities help in the training of samadhi. Ethical conduct, sustaining our attention, seeing the harmlessness of experience. Fearless observation and fearless questioning. When we are caught up in our story, to stop this madness and to ask from time to time, what's going on here? Is this, what is the truth here? Is this just mind configuration? What's going on here? To jar ourselves out of the story and to ask very fearless questions about our life and about our place within life. And it helps immediately. We step into a different way of perceiving that storyline. And to maintain an interest above all else in our inward life, to nurture that inward life, to be willing to go wherever it turns and wherever it mutates and wherever it seems to distort. All right, let me see. Denying no form of distortion. Let me look at this. Let's look at this. Then we'll be using this practice and not to seek special venues. If we seek special venues, know that we're practicing a particular skill within the meditation, and that's fine. But let us not, in general, seek special venues for our samadhi. If the confusion, the noise, the singing, the choiring, okay, let me just include this. Let me not resist. The less we resist, the more we'll include. The less we define our practice has to be quiet and specialized and no one around and no talking. That's such a fragile and inflexible practice. You just go this way. Just include it. And you find yourself with a very quiet mind holding all things. And none of them interfere. None of them interfere. And above all, and I leave you with this for the next 6 weeks, focus on connecting. Focus on connecting with and bringing the heart out. Wherever the heart takes us, and however we understand that, again, not to try to think that we don't have the deepest understanding, therefore have no practice at all. Wherever we understand the heart and the sense of connection, the engaged quality of interaction with ourselves, seeing what it is and how it is that we distance ourselves from the world, or how we place our objection constantly between ourselves and other people, move endlessly towards the correct orientation. Towards that abiding warmth and appreciation for things, then we'll be in the right direction. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, just being quiet, where is there a problem? Is the room too cold? The choir too loud? Your body too old? Which view are you going to hold in this moment? When we're interconnected, there's nothing wrong. But when we're desiring and fearing, everything needs tweaking. To know the difference. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. Yes.
Rodney, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about wise samadhi within, not on the cushion, but in day-to-day life, in terms of maybe wise samadhi as maybe how to have wise samadhi in a conflict situation, holding wise view at the same time.
Okay, the question is about wise samadhi in a ongoing, interactive kind of way, like in a conflict situation. Okay, so every situation is, of course, different, but let us say that there is anger or struggle going on with someone or something. What you'll notice is that there are two very different views, neither of them wise, that are in conflict. Because it's always a view that's in conflict. And what's not happening in that is that the one view is at all going to be altered by the other. That there's armament against each one and a protection of even listening. So what is the interconnected What does one need in a situation like that to interconnect? Okay, am I you have to ask very basic questions. I mean, connection is just, is first of all knowing what's going on in me. Oh, I'm angry. And secondly, what is it that's prohibiting connection in this moment with this person? The lack of listening. Okay, so now I'm facing my inability to listen because I want to hold on to my view. So we have the opportunity to move into wise view, but the resistance to maintain our unwise view and hold on to our own righteousness. So you see it right there. So, okay, there you go. Now what are you going to do? You're going to release and let go, or you're going to hold on and continue to struggle? You're not going to change their opinion. They're not going to change yours. But you're going to go off right, and so are they. There's no communication and no compromise. There's no mitigating circumstance there. So what are you going to do? You see? We're always going to be confronted. The choices will always be confronted by unwise or wise view. Those are where the two things clash. The sense of me and what I need and my control and influence and power, or what the situation calls for, which requires me to release the holding and the attachment that has created the conflict to begin with and open up to the spacious and interconnection that's there. There we go. So what are we going to do, you see? One's painful, the other isn't. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, because especially in this culture, we have to understand that we feel so diminished as people. I can't overemphasize that. That the moment that we think we have some right perception of things, or justifiably right, we will hold on to that tooth and nail, because it gives us a sense of having a place on the earth, a proper place on the earth, my righteous proper place. That's what I was trying to show last week when I was talking about one of the tasks of mindfulness is to show us our proper place on the earth, regardless of what mood we happen to be in or how much power we seem to be influencing in that moment. Always, mindfulness is a direct connection with our right place, our rightful place. And if we can go to that rather than to the sense of personal empowerment, then it makes much more sense that we can work with the personal empowerment and just release it, because we're this is it. We're here. We're being validated just by taking a seat here, just by standing on the ground. And it's that sense of the lack of validation that drives much of our righteous intention. If we can find that in a different way, then we can release the need for righteous for righteousness. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just showing us the problem. It's up to each one of us to navigate through that. Other comments or questions? Yes.
One of the cultural difficulties that you find trying to establish space for yourself are these individualized spaces. Facebook, YouTube, where people limit their contact to other people, describe themselves in their own individualistic ways. I mean, I haven't been on these things, but my kids tell me about them. Mm-hmm. I know they exist. They seem to be really centered in self.
Yes.
There's a paradox here that you're raising, that there is a dislike of self, and then I see young people really trying to emphasize self.
Right.
Sort of growing through that.
Right.
Help me understand that.
Right. the conflict between the sense that we dislike ourselves and yet we all start off, I mean, we start off with what we've been given. When we were small, we didn't have the personal discernment to see that the world was teaching us some distorted self-belief. So we molded around the imprints of the time. And then we came into our adulthood and we are left with the damage of those imprints. So much of what we do in meditation is to heal the damage of the past, is to get a sense that we're not as bad or disadvantaged or as much of a mistake as we believe, or a sense of failure as we believed ourselves to be. And we do that both perhaps therapeutically but also spiritually, because you begin to see that, oh, that was just an assumption. This is just assumptions that I've put on myself, that it really doesn't have any basis for actually describing who I am. They are just assumed roles and images, and they don't really hold up when I start really looking at either the truth of those assumptions or the truth of the moment in relationship to those assumptions. So we have to go through perhaps a prolonged period of time in which we're healing to the past, to the disadvantaged parts of ourselves, and try to bring a different perspective of self-acceptance, of self-appreciation, of liking ourselves, perhaps self-love. We do this through a whole variety of skillful means, including metta. Not because loving ourselves is worse or better than disliking ourselves. It just gets us to a playing field in which we can actually ask questions about ourselves. Who am I? What am I? We can't do that when we hate ourselves and we are in such resistance and such antagonism to that very image. We're never going to ask questions that are questions of clarity and discernment of those images when we are running from those images. We have to heal to the disadvantaged wounds and then ask those questions. A loving sense of self is no less self-aggrandizing than a diminished sense of self. But it's an awful lot easier to ask relevant questions from that position. And that's what we're trying to get to. What am I? Who am I? Is ultimately what we're going to ask to see. What is there? What is this? Does that make sense? Yeah. Tuari.
I think I want to ask a question about whether there's a quality about samadhi. Meaning, recently I have been experiencing these moments, well, it's longer than a moment. It could be up to a half an hour, or I just sort of experience everything that's sort of happening. But there's no pleasantness about it. There's no unpleasantness about it. I don't really know how to explain it.
Well, you're the expanse of your meditation is increasing, mm-hmm. right? So you're noticing more and more of the accompanying components of the moment. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so that's what I would call, remember there was one pointed concentration and moment to moment concentration. You're moving into moment to moment concentration. Samadhi has the quality of quiet. It's very quiet in there. It doesn't mean things are quiet. That doesn't mean the absence of noise. It's just that it's undisrupted. It cannot be. It's undisrupted stillness. That is that noise cannot disrupt it, because noise is not where it abides. It doesn't abide in the absence of noise. It abides in seeing noise. When you see noise, that which sees noise is quiet. Right? So that's what samadhi is. Samadhi is not, it's a next step up from the moment-to-moment concentration I was pointing to, when things are just moving around. And there isn't an abider within samadhi. There's no focus on where that, there's no place where that hearing is occurring. It's not like you could point a finger and say, I am in samadhi. In fact, that would just be an unwise view. Samadhi holds the thoughts of that location, but doesn't abide within that location. Does it? So that's about as close as I can do verbally with this very difficult description. Yes.
So when you're meditating and you're experiencing samadhi.
Yes. Yeah. The question is, focusing on your breath, and then suddenly you have this, where you're aware of much more than just your breath. Are you still focusing on your breath, or the breath may be one thing? In that, like if we're just quiet now, you may be aware of your body and also the sounds around. You may be aware of particular physical sensations or sights. But there's no one focus for where the attention is going. It's more, instead of like a flashlight pointing at you, it's more like turning on the lights in the room and it's the whole thing is a light. So don't get too concerned about that. Stay with the training manual. And that is what I said of those four or five points of what I was talking about. Ethical conduct, just looking at experience and seeing the harmlessness of it. Asking pertinent questions, very fearless questions about your situation. The whole thing is really stimulated by your intentionality for yourself. That's really what governs the speed, the sincerity, the direction, and ultimately the end of your search is your intentionality. So keep that wise intention and look for the deepest yearning, not the superficial yearnings that have long since confiscated our attention, but look beyond that. Look to the deepest yearning of the heart and establish intentionality with that deepest yearning, and that will really cover the whole of the practice for you. Yes.
I wanted to know how samadhi is similar to or different from resting in the nature of mind.
Can you define resting in the nature of mind?
Yes, I can. From the Tibetan.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. But resting in the nature of mind could mean many things. She's asking, what's the similarity of samadhi and resting in the nature of mind? I'm not that familiar with the Tibetan meaning, what they're meaning by that.
I think that Ajahn Sumedho, Intuitive Awareness, is talking about that.
Uh-huh.
In his latest book, Intuitive Awareness. I think he's closely talking about that.
Well,
and that's,
I don't really know the definition of that, but it certainly could be synonymous, depending upon what is meant by that, because resting in the nature of mind is resting in the inherent awareness, free of abiding in thought. So what happens then is that this sense of presence opens up beyond thought. The presence has always been there, which is an inherent natural quality that has been confiscated and contracted by thought, opens up. And there is the nature of mind or nature of heart. There is the unconditioned as well as the conditioned. There is the relative as well as the absolute. So depending upon what they mean, if they mean that, then it's the same. It's the same.
It's the same as samadhi.
Yes. So that would be the same as samadhi in the way I'm using it.